Okay, so today we're going to look at the parable of the tenants. If you're looking at the New King James or the King James Version, it may say the wicked husbandmen, but I can't say that word, so I'm going to stick with tenants throughout this class. Say again?
She understands.
Oh, okay, all right. I'm telling you, I'm not kidding when I said I did not get good sleep last night, so... you'll find this in Matthew chapter 21, verses 33 through 46. We will read from that one. We'll spend most of our time in that, in that passage. But you'll also find it in Mark chapter 12, verses 1 through 2. And you'll also find it in chapter 20, verses 9 through 19. Now, there are some interesting differences from the different Gospels. And I always kind of like that because you get a different perspective from whoever's writing it. So we'll spend some time, a little bit of time going back and forth. But like I said, most of today's class could be coming from Matthew's. So when did this occur? So there's some certain events that led up to this particular parable. And it really plays into why this particular parable occurs when it does. So does anybody have an idea of what just happened? And to be fair, I didn't give y'all a warning which parable we're going to do, so it's okay if you don't know. Okay, well, if you look back a chapter, you'll see that Jesus had just made his triumphal entry. That's the big thing that just happened. So he comes in to Jerusalem. He's doing his triumphal entry. There's hosannas being sung. And then from there, he goes and he cleanses the temple. Okay, and I'm looking at, I said the previous chapter, but I meant chapter 21, verses 1 through 11. That's where the triumphal entry. The cleansing of the temple. So right after you have the triumphal entry, then he cleanses the temple, right? All the money grubbers and money changers. And so he cleans them out of there. And at the end of that, I've read this 100 times. I don't know why I've never really realized it. But at the end of that, he's healing people. And again, people are singing his praises and singing hosannas. And after that, not surprisingly, the priests and the scribes and the Pharisees and all those fun people, looking at around verse 23, that's where they start challenging his authority. They start asking him, where does your authority come from? And how does he respond to that? Do y'all remember? You know this. They say, where... Okay, that is where he gets his authority. But when they ask him that, he turns it around on them and says,
"About David, who is his son?
Who gave John his authority? By whose authority does John teach?" Now they were scared. Okay, I'm moving a little too fast. Let's take a look at that.
Yes, please.
Chapter 21, verses 23 through 27. We are in Matthew. Matthew chapter 21, verses 23 through 27. And when he entered the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came up to him as he was teaching and said, "By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority?" Jesus answered them, "I will also ask you one question. And if you tell me the answer, then I will tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, from where did it come? From heaven or from man?" So that's specifically what he asked them. Where did it come from? And they discussed it among themselves. If we say from heaven, he will say to us, "Why then did you not believe him?" But if we say from men, we are afraid of the crowd, for they all hold that John was a prophet. So they answered Jesus, "We do not know." And he said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." So Jesus didn't answer their question really. But it's interesting that he doesn't say, well, to me, I find it interesting that he says, "I will also not tell you." He doesn't make a statement on correcting them, on giving them an answer on John. He just says, if you're not going to answer me, I'm not going to tell you by what authority I'm speaking. But it's in that conversation that he provides two parables, and we're going to actually spend most of our time on the second parable. But I will say in passing that the first parable, it's the two sons. So it's the two sons. You have the one son that was said, yes, I will do what you say, Father. The other son says, no, I'm not going to do that. So the one who says I'm not goes back and does it, and the one who says he will does it. So which one was the obedient one? So in that conversation, he's trying to make a point to them about being obedient to God. Okay, now we're going to talk about the tenets. Sorry, I said all that just to get us to the parable that we're actually going to talk about. So if you'll follow along, I'll be in Matthew 21, verses 33-46. And I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Hear another parable. There was a master of a house who planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower and leased it to tenants and went into another country. When the season for fruit drew near, he sent his servants to the tenants to get his fruit. The tenants took his servants and beat one, killed another, stoned another. Again, he sent other servants, more than the first, and they did the same thing to them. Finally, he sent his son to them, saying, they will respect my son. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and have his inheritance. And they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. When therefore the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? They said to him, he will put those wretches to a miserable death and let out the vineyard to other tenants who will give them the fruits in their season. And Jesus said to them, Have you never read in the scriptures, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone? This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, I tell you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing its fruits. And the people who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces. And when it falls on anyone, it will crush him. When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parables, they perceived that he was speaking about them. And although they were seeking to arrest him, they feared the crowd because they held him to be a prophet. Okay, so let's go ahead. So once again, Jesus is using an analogy that they would be very familiar with, or an idea that they would be very familiar with, which was vineyards. That's something that anybody at that time would have known what he was talking about. So when he described the vineyard, he talked about several things that the owner did in order to prepare the vineyard. So what were some of those things that he did?
Around it, cultivated it, like a farmer would do on a farm.
He fenced it, he hedged it, he planted the vines, right? He installed a wine press, and then he built a tower. So I want to talk about the wine press really quick. Are y'all familiar with what they're talking about when they say that he built a wine press? To me, I'm thinking you get wood, you get bowls, or something, some sort of big structure. Okay, so at that time, that wasn't me. At that time, the wine press would have been something that they would have either taken stone and built, and it would have been like a large vat that somebody would actually stand in and stomp around to stomp the grapes, right? So this would be a large vat. And either they would do it by, or they would build it by either laying stone, or they would actually carve it out of the bedrock. And then, after they get that, go through that much work, they build this like a trench, the trough. So they actually build two troughs. So you build one trough where you get the main runoff, and then another trough where you get the runoff from the higher trough. Same thing, you got to build it out of stone, or you have to chisel it out of the bedrock. Now, I say that to say we're talking about a lot of work. We're not talking about something that somebody does on one afternoon. Same thing with building a tower. Now, the tower may have had the idea of being able to put grapes in it, but I'm going to tell you later that really I think it's the idea of having a place where somebody can stand and watch and guard and look out for thieves and for animals that would take the produce and steal from the produce. So there was a lot of effort that went into building this, which shows that it was important to him what he was building here. And not only that, but the owner was building something that the tenants would have everything they need in order to operate this farm, to get their produce. So it wasn't a fly-by-night operation by any means. Let's see. So he left so when he left the farm, he went to a far country. What were they supposed to give him in return?
The fruit,
at least some of the fruit, a portion of the fruit, and that was basically their rent. And the question, the thing that I found interesting there, time for me to wake up. The thing that I found interesting there was that it says his fruit. It didn't say some of the fruit or some of their fruit, but some of his own fruit. So everything that he built there was for his fruit. And it wasn't just fruit that grew there wild. Now, I'm going to come back to that in a minute because I like Isaiah 5, 1 through 7, because there comes a question later on where he's talking about Jesus is talking about the Jewish religion. But we'll get back to that. I'm sorry. So at this time, did the tenants have any comments about the fairness of his asking for the fruit?
At the time of the agreement, whatever agreement they had, I didn't see what it was for.
And I only bring that up because what did he do? What did the tenants do with the servants who showed up and were asking for this? They beat them, they killed them, they stoned them, and they did this several times. So at no point do they give any indication that these tenants were thinking, thought that they were being unfair, or excuse me, that the owner was being unfair to them.
Apparently they did think that, according to the way that they treated the servants that came to them. So
they didn't think he's unfair. They just greedy.
Right. Yeah. That's the point. That's the point that I was trying to make with that is that at no point is there any indication that they felt like they had a grievance.
Yeah.
It wasn't they felt like they were being treated unfair, or they felt like it was an unfair agreement. It was just, they just wanted to keep it all for themselves. Okay? And so they thought they could keep it by force, and they would keep everything for themselves. But God is due his fruits. And I think that's one of the main things that they're trying to teach. What he's trying to say right there is that the owner is due his fruits, and he has a right and a reasonable expectation to get those fruits. So it culminated with the owner sending his son, which of course represents Jesus, and the son shows up, and instead of them respecting the son, of course, they killed him. Now, in this parable, they killed him because why?
Say that again, brother.
They killed him because?
Inheritance.
Yeah. The inheritance. I almost don't want to spend too much time on that, but that's interesting that they thought that they could kill him and there'd be no inheritance going to anybody else, which tells me what? Say again? It sounds like it's saying that that's his only son. And to me, similar to what it was, the situation with Jesus, and he's the only son of God. Okay. At this point, now Jesus has gotten to the point to where he has said that they killed the son. So, but he doesn't finish the story for them. Or according to Matthew's account, he doesn't really finish the story for them. He stops and asks them a question. What question was that?
About the baptism of John.
Jesus stops and he says, when the owner of the vineyard comes,
what will he do?
Now, if you look in, I said it was Mark and Luke, that they don't really ask that question. They don't answer that question. Jesus actually answers that question, is how it looks. But the thing I like about Matthew is that it gives that moment in between where Jesus says, what will he do? And go on to say what the owner is going to do. And their answer is, verse 41, he will put those wretches to a miserable death, let out the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the fruits in their season. Okay, so who's that answered that question? So we have people who are listening were the scribes and the Pharisees and elders of the church, or not church, elders of the Jewish elders. So they answered that question, and Jesus responds to that by repeating it apparently. And I'm going to go over I'll tell you what, I'm going to stop there for a second. What do you think the responders were thinking about right then when they said that? Because when I listened to it, I went surface level. So what do y'all think he was thinking about? The responders. When they said to him, he will put those wretches to a miserable death and let out the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the fruits in their season, I felt like they were being worldly. They were just saying, this seems just. It seems like, eye for an eye kind of thing. But this is not the first time that Jerusalem or Israel is compared to a vineyard. So if you take a look at Isaiah chapter 5, here Israel is also compared to a vineyard. The writer says, let me sing for my beloved my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. So I'm going to skip down to verse 7. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed for righteousness, but behold, an outcry. Okay, so the reason I bring that up is you've got scribes and elders and Pharisees who are listening to this, to him telling this story about these tenants. I suspect they had that in mind. That suddenly when these people are saying answers this question, that the owner's going to come back and kill these people, I think a light bulb starts to come off in some of their heads. They start realizing that he's talking about Israel, that he's talking about them. And it does say later that during the parable, while he's speaking the parable, they start realizing that he's talking to them. So in Isaiah, we find out God established his people. He expected good fruit, and he got wild fruit. Okay, and so that's very similar. It's not exact parallel, right? Because we don't have the tenants in the parable. But it does talk about the amount of effort that he took to set it up. And one verse that I saw in there that I found really interesting was verse 4. I'm talking about back in Isaiah chapter 5. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? So he has given them, so in the same regard that he's talking about, that he did everything he could to set up the vineyard of Israel.
He had it ready.
He did everything that he was ready for the tenants. So he planted the vineyard, built a tower, hewed out a vat, and hedged it in. That was also in the scripture in Isaiah. So it's basically the same thing. So here's the question. Who in this were the tenants? Who were the tenants in the parable?
The
priests and the elders and the scribes and the Pharisees, those guys were the tenants. Okay, so if you look, I'm sorry for jumping back and forth. If you look in Luke, an interesting thing that gets yelled out. Sorry. So if you look at verse 16, make sure I'm in the right chapter, Luke 20, verse 16. So Jesus is saying he will come and destroy those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When they heard this, they said, "Surely not." Now, what I find interesting is in Matthew, and this is the part where it's nice to be able to look at different books or different gospels of the same with the same parable. Sorry. In Matthew, we find out that actually it was the people he was talking to that gave him the answer to the question that the master would return and would kill them all and let it out to other people, and then Jesus repeats that. And then the same crowd that he's talking to says, "Surely not." So that tells me that there was a differing opinion in that same crowd that he was talking to. And some people suddenly realize, hey, he's talking about us here. Right. Put him in a place where he had to answer the question. And once he answered the question.
So David didn't realize until then either.
And as a matter of fact, David had to be told it was him. That is one difference, is that David had to be told. These people didn't have to be told. They perceived it on their own.
But then they say no.
Yeah, they're like, "Oh, surely not. Surely not." Because they understood his parable that it was the house of Israel was the vineyard, and they didn't want to talk about the possibility that they were going to be destroyed. Who's the new tenants?
The Gentiles.
Yeah, you're on the right track. Who's the new tenants? Okay, in this parable, you had the old tenants would have been the priests and the Jewish elders, and the new tenants are us. So I'll talk about that in a little bit later, but that's one of the main things that I found interesting when I was doing my takeaways. Okay. Okay. So who is the master? Who is the owner? God. So God was the owner of the vineyard. He's the one who prepared everything. The vineyard itself in the Old Testament was the house of Israel. In the New Testament, it would be the church. And the tenants would be, of course, the priests versus the Christians. And the servants. Who were the servants in this parable who kept coming back to them and saying, give the master the fruits that he's due? The prophets. The prophets kept coming back, but the prophets were stoned and they were killed regularly. And of course, the Son is the Son of God. All right, at the end of this, when Jesus was making his point, he said, "The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it's marvelous in our eyes. So, in what way did Jesus become the cornerstone?
When he died on the cross?
He became that, right? He became that. Let's take a look at this. Let's look at Psalms. I've got several scriptures here that I'm going to read through having to do with this stone being rejected in the cornerstone. Psalms 118, verse 22, they surrounded me. Oh, I wrote down the wrong scripture. Oh, okay. Actually, I was looking in the wrong place. I'm sorry. Psalms 118, verse 22. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. So, of course, Jesus, that's a prophecy, right? Because Jesus was rejected. Isaiah 28, verse 16. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am the one who has laid as a foundation in Zion, a stone, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone of a sure foundation. Whoever believes will not be in haste. And in Daniel chapter 2, verse 34 through 35. Uh-oh. There we go. I was about to say, I don't think my Bible had that. Daniel chapter 2, verses 34 through 35. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. 1 Peter 2, 4 through 8. I know I'm going through these kind of quick. I should have marked these. I'm sorry. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 4 through 8. As you come to him, a living stone rejected by men in the sight of God, chosen and precious, you yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For it stands in scriptures. Behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a cornerstone chosen and precious, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame. So the honor is for you who believe, but for those who do not believe, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. Okay, one more. 1 Corinthians 1:23. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. And okay. So those are just some scriptures that I wanted to go through that talk about how Jesus is the cornerstone for the church today, and how he how everything is built basically around him. Been a long way to get there, but okay. So when in the New Testament, we're, like I mentioned before, the Christians are the new tenants. And one of the things when I was reading that is I remembered in Romans that Paul is dealing with Gentiles, and well, I shouldn't say dealing with. He's speaking to Gentiles. And at that time, he's having to deal with the issue of sin. I don't know, grace, right? Because in chapter 6, he brings up the question of, shall we continue in sin? What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? So he's dealing with the idea that, that a lot of people are believing that it's okay to go ahead and sin so that they may, right, so that grace may abound. Thank you. But in chapter 11, he takes the time to address them specifically, because just because we're the new tenants doesn't mean that we're safe, because there's not going to be any tenants after us, because we are the end times. So we are the last tenants of this vineyard. But starting in 17 of chapter 11 of Romans, he says, "But if some of the branches were broken off and you, although a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree, do not be arrogant toward the branches. If you are, remember it is not you who support the root, but the root that supports you. Then you will say, 'Branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in.' That is true. They were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand fast through faith. So do not become proud, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you. Note then the kindness and the severity of God, severity toward those who have fallen, but God's kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off." So even the tenants that took over, that's us, we still have to beware and we still have to mind the vineyard. So in the parable, they knew that Jesus, or excuse me, they knew that the son was the son of the owner.
Yes.
So the question becomes, why didn't that stop them? If they knew it was the owner, let me rephrase that. Yeah, if they knew that that was the owner's son, why would that not stop them? And where's, I guess, I'm sorry, I'm trying to get to the point where I'm asking the question of, where's the parallel between the owner's son and them knowing that's the owner's son and the fact that Jesus was there and they could see the miracles that he was performing? And even though Jesus on the cross said, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do," so there was some level of ignorance on their part. They had to know that what they were witnessing was something special, right? They had to know that he had the power of God, because that's one of the reasons why they feared him so much, because he was going to shake things up and completely change everything.
Do you think that was really guilty, that everything could go back to the way it was? I mean, I've never understood if they knew how they rationed what they did.
You bring up an important point that once they killed him, they expected everything to go back like it was. They expected to keep everything. They expected not to have to give back the fruits.
They didn't believe that he was right, I guess.
And that's basically the same thing the Jews wanted. Yes, ma'am.
You know, Brother, I just finished reading through Jeremiah. And God refers to his people as a hard-hearted, stiff-necked people. They knew who Jesus was, the high priest. They had to know. And that's why...
I'm going to be very careful in saying that. I know that there was some... Obviously, they had everything they needed to know that, but I don't think so. I don't... Because even Jesus said, like I said, on the cross, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." They didn't realize what they were doing.
That's true too. And the reason why I say that is because when Jesus asked them the question about, they said, when Jesus asked them the question, you brought it up in Matthew, what was the question that Jesus asked them? Let me refresh my memory.
You're talking about what will the owner do when he returns?
Exactly. And they knew that they was talking about them. That's why I made that statement.
Okay, so I got ahead of us a little bit when I went down there, but I don't think they knew that at that point. I don't think they knew at that point that they were talking about, that Jesus was talking about them. Because otherwise, why would they say, he's going to come, well, of course he's talking about us. So why would they turn around and say, the master's going to come back and kill them all? Oh, wait a minute, that's us. I don't think so. I think it was like you said before on Daniel, is they answered the question. And then after they answered the question, light bulb started going off. And Jesus repeated the answer back to them. Yes, he's going to come back. He's going to kill them all. He's going to replace them with others. And then they said, surely not, because they realized that they're talking about replacing the house of Israel with Christians. Well, they didn't know Christians at that. But they just knew that what he was saying was they were going to get replaced. And that's why he followed it up with the stone that builders received has become a cornerstone. And later on, he says, and the one who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, and when it falls on anyone, it will crush them. So that was it was destroying. It was completely, it was going to destroy the Jewish religion. And it did. As far as the way it was practiced at the time. Okay. I do want to point out that there was a prophecy that he gave about himself at this during this parable. Or I should say he made a couple of comments that were prophetic in nature. So the obvious one was that he was going to be killed by the tenants, by the Jewish people. The Jewish people were going to make sure that he got killed. That was an obvious thing. The thing that was less obvious is the fact that in the parable, he was removed from the vineyard. And that was prophetic because Jesus was taken out of the city. He was not crucified in the city, right?
No, he was outside.
Okay. Does anybody... I know I'm sorry I didn't sleep last night, and I went through that much faster than I meant to. Does anybody have any questions or comments before we... Yes, ma'am.
What is fruit in parable that he wanted them to bear and that they wouldn't have bear? I would propose that it was justice to the poor, but he kept telling them over and over again.
So I'm going to repeat the question for the people who are listening on the internet. And so the question is, what is the fruit? And that is a good question, and I would ask the further question, what is the fruit today? Because in the Old Testament, the fruit more than anything is looking at, I think it's worship, I think it's Bible study, I think it's how we treat each other, whether or not we take care of the poor, whether or not especially we're going out into the world and preaching, we're spreading the gospel. So all of those things are the fruits of the spirits for today.
Something that they didn't want to do, they didn't want to give to people. Something they wanted to be greedy about, keep for themselves, I think is something to remember when we think about what the fruit is.
And I just got to say this. That's why it's so important that we evangelize.
Yes, that is why it's so important that we evangelize.
Evangelize, because Jesus made the direct command, go out and teach. So when we become Christians, we got to know that we need to get to work. It's not just for us to come here and sit on the pews and get all of this blessing and keep it to ourselves. But...
No, I'm going to agree with you, but I'm going to end it on saying, make sure that we are being fruitful, and make sure that that we understand that the fruit of our labors, the fruit of our efforts, the fruit belongs to God, and don't forget that. All right, we're done for today. No, I'm sorry. Next week, we're not going to be doing a parable. I've actually got a topic I want to talk about.